You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Clarice Lispector was once described as a woman who looked like Marlene Dietrich and wrote like Virginia Woolf. Although she'd been born to a Jewish family in western Ukraine, she grew up in Brazil, where she published her first novel, Near to the Wild Heart, when she was just 23. It began a career that has led many to consider her one of Latin America's finest writers of the 20th century. Benjamin Moser was on our show earlier this fall to discuss his book, Why This World, a biography of Clarice Lispector, and we thought that we would play that conversation again on this Thanksgiving Day. I began by noting that in a recent interview, Mr. Moser had mentioned that he first read Clarice Lispector's work when he was in college, and I asked him, do you remember which of her books you read first?
I do. I remember it very well. I was in a third semester of Portuguese class, and I found this tiny little book. It's less than 100 pages. It's called The Hour of the Star, and it's actually the book that she writes when she's dying. She doesn't really know that she's dying yet, but she is, and it's a tiny little book that brings together everything she had worked on throughout her life, and it made a huge impact on me.
Well, you were reading it in Portuguese.
That's right.
How important is style? Because being compared to Virginia Woolf, I wonder how that translates into Portuguese.
Well, it translates in her own language beautifully. I mean, she's one of the great masters of that language, and it's been more difficult to bring her over into English. There's been some translations that have been sort of hit or miss, but in Portuguese, she's considered the supreme stylist of the 20th century.
But did she bring something new to Portuguese in the way Virginia Woolf brought something new
Absolutely.
To English?
Absolutely. She sounded like a foreigner. She was, in fact, born in Europe, as you said, and she
escaping the pogroms.
Her mother was raped in the pogroms, and her family was completely ruined. And they came. I think we think of people who come to the New World as immigrants, especially Jews and Italians and Irish. You know, people coming to make a new life for themselves. But these were really refugees from one of the poorest and most miserable parts of the world, in the middle of the Russian Civil War, and a place where people ate their own children because they were starving, and she came to this place, and she grew up there. She got there when she was a little more than a year old. She grew up there, and still her language always sounded strange. It sounded like absolutely nothing else that had ever been written in Portuguese. And that's why in 1943, when this book comes out, she instantly becomes a figure that soon does grow to these mythical proportions.
Do you think that's because she grew up in a family that spoke Russian?
Yiddish. And,
So it's Portuguese has filtered through a foreign language.
She never really spoke Yiddish herself. I mean, she was too young at the time. But her sisters did and her parents did. And she had a very strange accent. She lisped, you know, she had this very weird accent. And she also
was grew up very full lips.
Very full lips. Maybe that was it.
Well, at least the picture on the cover shows.
Well, she was very beautiful.
She also put a lot of lipstick on.
She did, and she was very glamorous and very beautiful. And so that made. And she was married to a diplomat, and she lived in Europe and the United States. And so people didn't really realize how miserable her background was, but it was. And she created herself into this.
When did it occur to you that she was someone who would make a good subject for a biography?
Well, you never know, do you, when you start out? I mean, I was fascinated by her from the time I was in college, and I loved her. And I was talking about her. I was sitting in my garden in Holland, sort of saying, wouldn't it be great to do a book about Clarice Lispector? And the next day in southern Brazil, there's this biggest literary festival of the year was starting, and she was the featured classic author. Every year they have one great Brazilian author. And a friend of mine, an editor at Knopf here in New York, said, why are you sitting on your butt in your garden there when this thing's going on? Get on a plane. And I did the next day.
Well, has anything been written about her in Brazil? Is a biography been
Absolutely. Written? There's been so much written about her. And I went to this festival, and I mean, of course I knew she's a classic writer and everything. And
you say that she's as famous in Brazil as Borges is in Argentina.
Yes, absolutely. She's, you know, one of the two or three classic writers that everybody knows and from school and that people have real emotional attachments to, I think.
Well, Latin American writers don't always get read much in the United States. A perfect example is perhaps the greatest of all the Brazilian writers, Machado de Assis. He is loved everywhere, but it seems in the United States, despite the fact that he's a great writer. Roberto Bolaño only became famous after he died.
Well, writers, I think, especially in translation, are made rather than born. I mean, the idea that I was trying to do with this book, and the reason I'm here talking to you and all this, is to tell people about her, because it's very easy. You know, she's been dead for 30 years, and she wrote in this other language, and she lived in another country. I was really excited about talking about her just for that reason, because she's not around to speak for herself. So
now the name strikes me as odd, because it doesn't sound Portuguese to me. If my name was spelt that way, I would do Clarice Lispector or something like that.
Well, it's her native name. Her original Hebrew name is Chaya, and she took the name Clarice when she got to Brazil as a child. A lot of these names, Chayas often became Claras or Clarices or Clarissa. And Lispector is, I just found out on the internet, I had been baffled by this, but it's actually a name that's a bastardization of the word inspector. And it refers to people who, I think in the 18th century, were inspectors of Jewish schools in Western Russia.
And yet people suggested that this was a pseudonym.
It was a pseudonym when she first came out, because it was such a weird-sounding name. And actually, I've never found another family with this name. But, you know, it was a time when I think in America so many people have unusual names that it's not as surprising. But back then in Brazil, you know, most people had either Portuguese or Italian names, and something like this was... it was strange and it was weird, and now people think of her as a great Brazilian writer, and the question doesn't come up, but it is certainly something that was asked.
Benjamin Moser's book, Why This World, a biography of Clarice Lispector, is published by Oxford University Press. How would you describe the scope of her output? First of all, she grew up in a family that was not really assimilated. How did she become a writer?
Well, she became a writer in a very shocking way, actually. Her mother, who had been raped in this pogrom in Russia, was very sick with syphilis and eventually died when Clarice was 9.
She'd been given the syphilis because of the rape?
In this assault in Russia, when hundreds of thousands of Jewish women were raped or murdered.
And where was her father?
Her father was there as well. But she tells these stories as a little girl. She can't do anything about her mother, who has this untreatable disease. And so she tells these stories with magical endings, in which some fairy or some god or something comes along and sprinkles some dust and saves her mother. And I think that's what runs through her writing, which is so shocking and so beautiful, is that urgency that she never loses. She knows it doesn't work. She knows that you can't save the world through words and through these stories. But even when she is going to the hospital and dying, she's still telling stories to the taxi driver. She said, let's pretend we're not going to the hospital. Let's pretend we're going to Paris. And you can bring your girlfriend, too. And so that urgency, though, is something that I think is the heart of the emotional power of it.
But her sister, Elisa, also wrote novels, didn't she?
Yes, she did. Elisa was 11 years older than Clarice. And so she had experienced the whole horror of what had happened in Ukraine. And she was a very respectable novelist, but she wasn't... she wasn't the greatest writer of her century like her sister was. And so there was a lot of, there's a lot of misunderstanding, I think, of Elisa's work.
Well, why is Clarice considered by Brazilians to be such a mysterious figure? Is it because of the circumstances of her life or because she was so secretive?
Well, no, she both. And she came from a place that most people in Brazil didn't have any idea what it was. You know, as I said, she comes as a refugee. She's Jewish, where in a place where there aren't very many Jews. And she's this extremely beautiful woman. She has this weird voice. She writes these weird books that are written in this other language. And there's a kind of glamour about her and a kind of mystery about her. And she does cultivate that, especially toward the end of her life.
A journalist once said to her, they say you're evasive, difficult, that you don't talk. It doesn't seem that way to me. And she responded by saying, obviously, they were right.
Well, obviously, you know, that she does say that. And if she doesn't like the journalist, she won't say a word. But just as often, she'll open up and she'll give these incredibly candid interviews that are actually shocking to listen to. And she's an interviewer herself. And in her interviews, she ends up pretty much only talking about herself. So the interviewee doesn't really stand a chance.
So when you're putting together a book like this, and we're talking about a book that's nearly 400 pages, how do you separate truth from fiction?
Well, it's hard.
She's constantly inventing herself is guarded about herself. And you say she wanted nothing more than to rewrite the story of her birth.
Well, especially of her birth,
because
of what happens to her family and what happens to her mother. She fantasizes about going back to the town in Russia where she's born and being born again in other circumstances. But the amount of myth around her is incredible. I think that that's the fun of this, is that there's her, the person and the writer, and there's also her, the character, and her, the public figure.
Well, how much does she reveal in her fiction? How autobiographical is
it? Well, it's very autobiographical. It's very allegorical, and it's mystical. I mean, because God kills her mother, but she has this religious vocation, and so she tries throughout her life to make peace with this God that she's rejected because he killed her mother. And it's a very personal thing. It's not an abstract philosophical thing. It's very visceral. And in one of her most famous novels, she symbolizes that by a woman who gets locked into the maid's room in her apartment and ends up putting a dead roach into her mouth. And that's as a symbol of her hatred for God and her rage against God. And it's very powerful and it's very extreme, but it never leaves her.
Most writers would be really pleased to be compared to Virginia Woolf, was she?
She didn't like Virginia Woolf. She said that she couldn't forgive her for committing suicide. She writes, "The terrible duty is to go to the end." And she didn't like the Virginia Woolf comparison also because she didn't like being compared to somebody else or being thought of as derivative. She wasn't. She was tremendously original and she was tremendously brilliant.
Now, she was married to a diplomat. Was it a good marriage? We're talking about a troubled person here.
She was a troubled person in some ways. She liked, she wanted desperately to be a good wife and a good mother. And she married a man who, by all accounts, was terribly in love with her and always was, even after the marriage eventually broke up. She lived in Washington in the 50s when he was at the Brazilian embassy there. But from the very beginning of her fiction, she has this skepticism about marriage and about the possibility of union between two people. And eventually it's too much for her after 17 years. But her sister told me she did love him and she did value him, but she really just couldn't do it anymore.
How much of an impact did her striking looks have on the circumstances of her life?
Well, very
Men found her very attractive.
One of the most touching things about this whole process for me was meeting these men. She would be 89 now. So people who knew her...
She died in 77.
She died in 77. So she was born in 1920, so she'd be 89. And she was this incredibly stunning woman. It was fun to meet the men who had met her at the height of her beauty in her 20s and in her teens, who are now very old men themselves. Very few of them survive, but these old men with dentures and with no hair and kind of drooling and in wheelchairs. And suddenly I would say, so what did Clarice look like when you first met her? And all the old wrinkles and the drippy eyes, it all fell away and they sort of looked like they were 17 again, talking about how beautiful she was. They never forgot it.
Well, she once wrote, "I am so mysterious that I don't even understand myself."
Right. Well, she also said...
That's contributing to the myth, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think she means in the sense that she doesn't understand these very basic questions that the title of the book is, Why This World? You know, why are people born? Why do people die? Why are they punished by God for things that they... through no fault of their own? And these are questions that are... people, I think, ask very intensely in adolescence, and then they get a job, and then they get married, and then they live their lives, and they stop asking those questions because those questions are impossible to answer, and they're very painful. And she never really makes peace with that urgency that she feels as a young woman.
How did she deal with all the political turmoil of Brazil over the years?
Well, you know, she was in the Foreign Service. Yeah, she had, she was, of course, very patriotic as a Brazilian. She was very grateful of the country that had saved her family and that had given her a chance and that she represented abroad and that was where she grew up and where she felt a part of. But in the 60s, after 64, when this very brutal military dictatorship took over Brazil, which was not something that really had a was a tradition in Brazilian politics. She does, even though she's a very apolitical person and she's a very apolitical writer, she does get involved in the great protest marches that start happening in 1968 against torture and against this very arbitrary and brutal regime.
Was the regime as anti-Semitic as some of the Argentinian regimes?
Well, the Argentinian regimes, you know, they pushed people, living people out of planes into the ocean and things. It never got that bad in Brazil, but the Brazilian Jews were very scared of what could happen. And even though Brazil doesn't really have a tradition of anti-Semitism in the sense that Argentina does, there was a real fear of it. And she lost her job in 1973. She was fired from a newspaper because she was Jewish. And so that was always something that was very present for her.
Is there a renewed interest in her work? Are we going to see reissues of some of the novels that have gone out of print?
Yes. Well, in Britain, one of her great novels, The Apple in the Dark, is coming out in a couple of months in a new version. And here, you know, I hope that through talking about her and through, you know, exposing more people to her work, that people will go back and look at her work.
And we can look at her in the pictures that you've included in this book as well. Benjamin Moser's biography of Clarice Lispector is called Why This World, published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Up next, Harvard primatologist Richard Wrangham explains why he thinks cooking played a major role in human evolution. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.